Corin Garvey cherished the peacefulness of that quiet as it sank into his bones. Over the last few 5 days, his schedule had come to include sharing breakfast with Hector and Iris Applin Armagh, Prince Divan, and Lady Hanth and her children at least twice per 5 day, and those breakfasts were the high points of his day. Divan was always a joy, especially when Garvey remembered the frightened little boy who'd clung desperately to his father, weeping as he begged not to be sent away to safety. And that safety had done little to restore the boy's once buoyant nature. Iris had told him how Divan retreated into mouse-like timidity in Delphirach, how he'd slunk about, shoulders tight, sensing the danger without the age and experience to understand its cause. And she'd also described how he'd responded to Sajin Merlin and Lieutenant Applin Armagh, and, later, to Countess Hanth and Archbishop Michael. A cynical sort might have wondered if Iris had exaggerated that response to justify her decision to collaborate with the foreign despots who'd conquered her homeland. Sir Corin Garvey could be as cynical as anyone, but not when he saw how the boy sparkled in his brother-in-law's presence. And watching the orphaned prince with Myra Braegart and her children would have melted the hardest heart. Lady Hanth was always a pleasure herself, and then there was Iris. He'd treasured his cousin's sharp wit and sense of humor before her exile. It was good, very good, to hear that sense of humor once more, and even better to see her actually smile. Especially when he thought about how very close he'd come to never hearing her speak or seeing her smile again. His own smile faded as he considered the foreigner who'd kept that from happening. The Pasqualates were baffled by the Duke of Darkos's miraculous survival, but it was simplicity itself for the reformist laity. Miracles were the traditional way in which the archangels and the saints had been validated by God, and if Darkos was a bit on the youthful, wiry, possibly even scruffy side for one of the warrior saints of the war against the fallen, so what? He was most definitely a warrior, and Princess Iris was obviously saint fodder. Surely it was only reasonable for Pasquale to act through the avenue of her nursing and prayers to preserve the young husband who'd shielded her with his own body on the very steps of the cathedral on their wedding day. It was an irresistibly romantic tale. Not even the fact that it was true could make it any less romantic, or effective at generating support for Coruscant's incorporation into the Carisian Empire. The forces of evil had attempted to slaughter their princess and her new husband in a foul, murderous attack at the very doors of God's house. That attack confirmed who'd truly tried to kill Iris and Divan in Delphirach, and the totality of its failure proved Archbishop Claremont had spoken with the Archangel's own voice when he explained what the marriage between Princess Iris and the Duke of Darkos truly meant. Garvey was prepared to give that tale every ounce of public support, although as the man charged with keeping Iris and Hector alive, he also meant to remember the Archangels helped those who helped themselves. Hector's survival might well indicate divine approval, but Sir Corin Garvey had no intention of depending upon God to intervene so directly a second time.
Although if anyone deserves divine intervention, or constitutes it for that matter, it's probably Hector, he thought.
The mechanics of it were easy enough to explain. A simple case of someone who'd seen far more combat than someone his age should have and developed what Sajin Merlin called the situational awareness to recognize a threat. But that took nothing away from the act itself, or from the fact that when Hector Applin Armagh gathered Iris in his arms and covered her body with his own, it had been the deliberate decision of someone who'd realized only one of them could survive, and chosen for that someone to be the woman he loved. He'd turned out to be wrong about his own chance of survival, although he shouldn't have been, given the damage he'd taken. And he was also the only surviving witness who'd actually seen what had happened. They still had no clue where the assassin and the hapless victim in the wheelchair had come from, but Hector's testimony confirmed what the messages from the Watchers Sajin Merlin had left in Coruscant had already suggested must have happened. No one would ever know what had caught Sergeant Winston Frazier's eye. He'd been one of Garvey's hand-picked men, circulating through the crowd in civilian clothing, looking for something exactly like what had happened. But he'd been 50 yards outside his assigned area when the explosion killed him. Whatever had attracted Frazier's attention, it had been a glimpse of him lunging at the woman in the lay sister's uniform, which had drawn Hector's attention to the sudden sputter of smoke, the realization it had been spawned by a fuse. Without Frazier, he and Iris would certainly be dead, and Prince Divan had already decreed that the sergeant's two daughters would be raised as wards of the crown, and that his widow would receive an army colonel's pay for the rest of her life. It couldn't bring Frazier back to life, but at least the crown could acknowledge its debt to him by caring for his family. And much though Garvey might regret the sergeant's death, he was unspeakably grateful Frazier had been there to die for his princess. And for her husband. His eyes softened as he reflected on how deeply he'd come to value Hector Applin Armagh. The Duke was little more than half his own age, yet he'd seen at least as much combat. Indeed, he'd seen more of it. And the last thing Iris Georgette Mara Dakin had needed as a husband was some soft, pretty, well-educated, politically aware, polished, well-groomed, well-connected aristocrat who knew everything there was to know about court infighting and thought hardship was getting caught in the rain during a fox lizard hunt. Hector might be well-educated, and he was certainly politically aware, but he was also far from anything someone might call pretty, about as far removed from the polished aristocrat category as it was possible to imagine, totally disinterested in fox lizard hunting, and tougher than old boot leather. "Once upon a time I thought those Marines Caleb used to kick my ass were tough bastards," he reflected, "but Hector could give them toughness lessons any day of the 5-day. I wonder if it's something in the water in Caras." Whatever it was, Hector Applin Armagh had it in full measure. He'd floated in and out of consciousness, mostly out, for 3 days after the attack. On the 4th day, however, he'd awakened clear-headed and fully aware. In some ways, the Order of Pasquale seemed to find the speed of his recovery even more miraculous than the fact that he'd survived in the first place. It seemed unlikely he'd ever regain full use of his left hand, but aside from that, his wounds were healing with a speed which baffled the most experienced healer. He'd be convalescing for a long time to come, but he was already cautiously mobile, and from the smile Garvey had surprised on his cousin's face yesterday, that wasn't the only thing he was capable of now. Garvey chuckled again, this time with a broad grin, and gave himself a shake. If he dawdled much longer, he'd miss breakfast entirely. He headed down the hallway again, more briskly than before, turned into the cross corridor that led to the breakfast parlor, and slammed to a halt. The woman standing outside the breakfast parlor's hand-polished doors was approximately the same height as Iris, but she was clearly some years older. She was also strikingly attractive, with the red hair of one of the northern realms and eyes as darkly blue as Merlin Othrawis's own. Yet what drew the eye was the blackened breastplate of the Carisian Imperial Guard and the insignia of a captain. She stood neat as a cat lizard, hands folded before her, a sword identical to Major Othrawis's, or Emperor Caleb's for that matter, across her back, and what must be one of the new revolvers at her right hip. Not even the guard uniform and a breastplate could disguise her supple shapeliness, however preposterous it might be to see a woman armed and armored for war. But what struck Garvey most strongly in that first astonished moment was the serenity of those sapphire eyes, the calmness of her expression, and the strong, long-fingered hands of someone poised even here for instant, purposeful mayhem. Well, That and the fact that she couldn't possibly be here, and that he'd never seen her before in his life. "Good morning, General Garvey." She bowed slightly in salute. She had a pleasant voice, a corner of Garvey's mind noted, a bit on the deep side for a woman, with a musical, throaty edge. "Good morning," he heard himself reply, as if she had a perfect right to stand outside this door. Unfortunately, she most certainly did not. For that matter, he found himself wondering why none of the alert, highly trained guards he'd stationed around Monchir Palace, especially since the Cathedral Square attack, had so much as mentioned her to him. A black breastplate and an unusual sword were far from sufficient to win free passage to the heart of his prince's living quarters without his personal and very specific approval. And I'm pretty damned sure I'd remember approving her presence. The tartness of the thought broke the grip of his astonishment, and he cocked his head, acutely aware, for some reason, of his own lack of weapons. "May I ask what you're doing here, Captain?" he asked a bit coldly, eyes flicking to the shoulder insignia and then back to her face. "And may I also ask how you happen to be here without anyone's mentioning you to me?"
"Emperor Caleb and Major Othrawis sent me to augment security for Prince Divan and Princess Iris, sir," she replied calmly, in an accent that reminded him of someone else. "It wasn't intended as any sort of an aspersion on Coruscant's ability to protect them, and what I've discovered so far about the Cathedral Square attack, especially what Duke Darkos had to say about the actual assassin, suggests you and your men were very much on your toes. Even if it didn't, I have firm instructions not to interfere with your procedures and operations in any way. His Majesty intends me as an adjunct, attached personally to Prince Divan, Princess Iris, and Duke Darkos, not as any sort of replacement for Sergeant Raymer or any other member of their regular detachments."
"That's very generous of His Majesty," Garvey said, a shade more tartly than he'd intended, and suppressing an urge to point out that, whatever might happen in the future, Caleb Armok was not yet his emperor. "It doesn't, however, explain why no one warned me you were coming."
"I arrived late last night, bringing my orders with me, sir. You'd already retired, most of the palace staff had done the same, and I felt it would be rude to awaken you simply to hand you my orders."
Garvey's eyes narrowed. He started to observe that he saw the shipping movement reports every morning, and that, according to them, no ships had arrived from Old Corus or the Republic of Sidermark in the last 5 days, including last night, then thought better of it. He was beginning to cherish certain suspicions about the woman in front of him and how she might have arrived so tracelessly in Coruscant.
"And the reason none of the members, the regular members, of Prince Divan's personal guard saw fit to mention your presence when I arrived at the palace this morning, Captain?"
There was more than a trace of true anger in his voice this time. He didn't care if she'd been sent by Merlin Othrawis, Caleb Armok, or Langhorne himself. She did not have authority to issue orders to Divan or Iris's armsmen. And she most assuredly had no authority to tell them not to report the arrival of an armed stranger who'd arrogated access to the royal family to herself, and they damned well knew it.
"I'm afraid they don't know I'm here yet, sir," she responded a bit apologetically. "It seemed simpler to just wait outside Princess Iris and Duke Darkos's apartment until they woke up, and I could present my orders from His Majesty directly to them."
"It seemed simpler to—"
Garvey chopped himself off and forced himself to draw a deep, calming breath. So she'd gotten inside the palace walls without being challenged by the regular sentries or the royal guard's elite, highly trained men, walked upstairs to Princess Iris's personal fourth-floor apartments, and parked herself in the hallway outside those apartments, apparently disguised as a potted plant to remain unobserved by any of the servants, without anyone even noticing? He felt a headache coming on, and he was quite sure he recognized that accent now.
"Tell me, Captain," he said, "how well do you know Sajin Merlin?"
"Quite well, actually, sir," she smiled slightly. "We're both from the Mountains of Light, and I've known Major Athrawis all my life."
"And would it happen you and the Sajin share certain abilities, shall we say?"
"We do have many of the same skills," she acknowledged. "We studied under the same masters, you see."
"Yes, I think I am beginning to see." His answering smile showed his teeth. "And would it happen that one of the reasons Sajin Merlin, Emperor Caleb, selected you for this assignment is that Princess Iris and Prince Divan already know and trust you?"
"Princess Iris and Duke Darkos, certainly, sir. I'm afraid I was never introduced to Prince Divan, although he seemed perfectly happy when his sister explained my presence to him this morning."
She returned his smile much more tranquilly. "I think the fact that Sajin Merlin sent His Highness a personal note to introduce me probably didn't hurt."
"I see."
Garvai hooked his thumbs into his belt, settling back as he regarded the highly attractive young woman in front of him, and wondered once more why so many Sajins had chosen to come out of the woodwork and offer their services to the House of Armagh. It wasn't that he objected to it, but it would be nice to have some idea just what the Shan Wei was going on. Before whatever it was hit him with an even bigger clue stick, at least.
"Well, Captain," he said finally, "it seems I'm stuck with you. I trust you won't take my choice of verb wrongly."
"Of course not, sir."
Her voice was as serene as ever, but he saw a flicker of amusement in those dark blue eyes of hers.
"Good."
He felt the corners of his own eyes crinkle as his sense of the absurd came to his rescue.
"And since I am stuck with you, Sajin, may I ask what your name is?"
For a moment he thought she was going to inform him, as Merlin had on more than one occasion, that whatever anyone else might think, she didn't call herself a Sajin. Obviously, however, she thought better of it. Perhaps even Merlin would eventually realize there was no point denying the painfully obvious. Instead, she simply gave him another of those tranquil smiles and inclined her head in another slight, respectful bow.
"Of course, General Garvai," she murmured. "You may call me Nimmu."
Chapter 6. Allenton, Midhold Province, Republic of Sidermark.
"Hard to imagine less promising weather for a campaign," Kent Clarake thought with profound satisfaction, standing at the window of his Allenton headquarters. A few weary snowflakes spiraled down from a leaden sky, skipping across the frozen streets on a glacial wind, until they settled in herringbone patterns. The corners of the window panes showed traceries of ice too heavy to be called frost, and despite his office's warmth, the cold beyond that glass bit deep. It was an imagined bite. The memory of how frigid that cutting wind had been during his inspection rounds, and the temperature was about to plunge even lower as soon as evening dwindled into night.
"The only good thing about it," he continued, considering the meteorology data, "is that it's going to get still worse."
He smiled thinly, then turned his back on that dreary vista and seated himself behind his desk. One thing that never changed was that his endless paperwork remained inversely proportionate to the amount of time in which he had to do it. Brian Slocum and Alain Powers took as much off of him as they could, but there was a limit to how much they could save him from. And he was grateful, in a way, that that was the case. It gave him something to do while he waited for the weather to worsen. Now that Sir Brate Boscombe, the Earl of Highmount, had arrived with the final echelon of the Imperial Carisian Army, the Group of Four's opportunity to simply sweep the board was a thing of the past. It had, in the words of a famous old Earth general, been the nearest run thing you ever saw, but the Army of God had fallen just short.
It had been stopped in places like the Silmon Gap and along the Divin River by the sacrificial gallantry of Sidermarkian regulars and Carisian marines, and in 1,000 other nameless places by the sheer determination of loyal men and women to die where they stood. Most of their names would never be known, but they were the ones who'd bought the knife edge of time, bought it in blood, and sealed it with their deaths for a single reinforced Carisian division to reach the Republic. There had been 26,000 men in that first echelon. Now there were over 300,000 Carisian soldiers, not counting the purely logistical troops supporting the ICA's supply lines, and a new Republic of Sidermark army had risen from the ashes of mutiny, rebellion, and death to march towards the sound of battle with their Carisian allies. 5 RSA rifle divisions were already at the front or on active operations against Temple Loyalist guerrillas. 10 more, another 130,000 men, had almost completed their training, and 15 more would begin the same process within the next few 5 days. They couldn't put any more of the new divisions into the field yet because there simply weren't sufficient rifles to arm them, and the RSA would never again send pikemen into battle, but by next spring they would be ready for field service. And in the meantime, with Highmount's arrival, the original scheme for the ICA's organization, somewhat modified by circumstances, had finally been put into place. Duke Eastshire's command in O'Hodlan's Gap had become the Army of the Brannaths, and when it was fully up to strength, including its attached Sidermarkian units, it would muster 70,000 men, 30% of them mounted. Green Valley's own Army of Midhold would be a bit stronger than that, with almost 76,000 men, including 16,000 Carisian mounted infantry. The Army of Cliff Peak, under Highmount's command, would count another 69,000, in his case, all Carisians with no Sidermarkian attachments. The Army of Divin, under General Simkin, would hold the Glacierheart Gap against Catesworth's demoralized Army of Glacierheart with roughly 75,000 men, while General Barton Somerset commanded the Army of Old Province. 43,000 men who formed the Allies' primary reserve in Sidar City. 2 more independently deployed mounted brigades had been sent south from the capital, where they would soon be teaching the Temple Loyalist guerrillas in the triangle of the South March lands between Southguard and the Tygan River how Carisian dragoons dealt with rapists and murderers. The Allies remained outnumbered in all 3 active theaters, but that didn't worry Green Valley. Properly employed, the Army of God could still put up a dangerous defense, and next year, if Narman and Owl's estimates held up, it might well become a dangerous offensive force as well. For now, however, it was well and truly pinned, and it would shortly discover it was in rather worse state even to defend itself than it thought it was. But the Army of God wasn't the Allies' primary target just at the moment. No, that honor had been granted to the Army of Shiloh, which was not, he thought with profound satisfaction, likely to enjoy the experience. And neither is Bishop Militant Barnaby. Harless and Alvarez may be the primary objective, but that doesn't mean we don't have a little attention to spare for their friends. And the canal ice will be thick enough to support infantry in 3 more 5 days. By mid-February, it'll be thick enough for field guns, and Nibor's boys will be feeling the chill by then. The Army of God's creators had fully understood the brutality of the high northern climate and how difficult it would become to move supplies once the canals froze. That was why they'd never intended to wage any winter campaigns in northern East Haven. Like a certain head of state from Old Earth named Adolf Hitler, however, they'd been stopped short of their summer campaign's intended goals, and after Halcombe Barnes's rampage through the canal system, their supply echelons were in even worse shape than the Wehrmacht's had been in the winter of 1941. The canals were inoperable. Even Safeholdian high roads were breaking down under the weight of so much freight traffic, and Worsham had been forced to send as many draft dragons as possible to the rear. He hadn't wanted to reduce his transport capacity, but the majority of those dragons that hadn't been sent back to some place they could survive the winter had very limited life expectancies. Most would be providing rations to his infantry within the next month. The good news, insofar as there was any good news for the Army of the Silmon, was that it was animal-powered, with no need for gasoline or spare parts, and that its relatively primitive weapons ammunition needs didn't begin to approach those of a mechanized old Earth army. It still needed to ship food, however. Worse, it needed to ship that food at a time when its available transport was still overwhelmed trying to evacuate Temple Loyalist civilians from the wasteland the Sword of Schuller had created. And in the process, it had been stretched far too thin, and not just where food was concerned. Its creators had designed proper cold weather uniforms, but they hadn't made enough of them, and its crippled logistics couldn't distribute even the ones it had properly. Worsham's divisions were already losing men to frostbite. Some of them, under worse-than-average conditions, had actually died of hypothermia. Given what had happened to so many Sidermarkian civilians the previous winter, Green Valley found it difficult to feel much sympathy. Robert Ducairne was doing all he could to move winter clothing forward, but it wasn't simply a problem of transporting the needed uniforms. There were too few of them to transport because of how badly the AOG had underestimated its needs when it ordered them. Maguire and his bishops militant had anticipated breaking through to the eastern side of the Snow Barrens and the Moonthorns, where the weather was far milder. Now, with their armies stopped short, the obvious move was to pull all of them back, not just the pikemen. But Jaspar Clinton had quashed the notion of giving up a single foot of occupied ground as firmly as Hitler ever had, and there simply weren't sufficient winter uniforms to go around. And to make the Army of the Silmon's woes complete, the mainland textile industry, unlike Ryan Mikhail's Corisian manufactories, couldn't have made the necessary clothing on such short notice, even if there'd been no transport problems at all. The Church of God Awaiting was conducting clothing drives, collecting as many winter garments as it could, but the pre-Merlin textile industry had never produced clothing in the abundance an industrialized society took for granted. Safeholdian garments were well made, for the most part, but the supply was finite. Most of the truly heavy winter clothing on the planet was needed right where it was, and muscle-powered manufactories couldn't mass-produce more of it quickly. Powered looms and sewing machines had become weapons of war as surely as any rifle, and not even Robert Ducairne had seen that one coming. It was a sign of the Army of the Silmon's dire straits that foraging parties spent as much time ransacking abandoned farmsteads and towns for salvageable clothing as for food or the building materials to construct winter quarters. And all of that combined to deprive the Army of God of anything remotely like mobility. Without sufficient food and fodder, inadequately clothed men and overworked animals simply lacked the energy for aggressive marching or patrolling in sub-zero winter. They were forced to huddle in whatever shelter they could cobble up, husbanding their energy and avoiding frostbite, and fuel was already in short supply.
Russell's the main show, Green Valley thought, and that makes perfectly good sense, given how much better the campaigning conditions are going to be in southern Cliff Peak and the South March. I understand that. But Worsham and I will do a little dancing of our own in another month or two, and this time I get to call the tune.
He concentrated on his paperwork far more cheerfully than usual, whistling softly, and if anyone else had been present, they probably would have recognized the melody. It was called The Pikes of Colsteer.
February, Year of God, 897. Chapter 1. Camp Number 4, Bedard Canal, west of Mosgir, Duchy of Gwent.
Sean Way, it's cold out there!
Sergeant Elaine Talbot had his arms wrapped tightly about himself as he entered the well-chinked cabin and kicked the door shut behind him. He crossed to the fireplace, pulled his hands out of his armpits, blew on them, rubbed them briskly together, then held them out to the crackling fire. The log-formed, clay-coated fireplace and chimney were not perfect specimens of design or workmanship, and tendrils of smoke curled up around the rough mantle, but that was a minor price for the blessed warmth, in Talbot's considered opinion.
"You think this is cold?"
Sergeant Tangwin Singpu laughed, looking up from the belt he was mending. The sergeant spoke with a pronounced Harchongese accent, reasonably enough.
"Visit me and Thomas after the jihad. I'll show you cold."
Talbot rolled his eyes. Singpu was scarcely the only member of the 231st Volunteer Regiment who needled him about the weather. And the other sergeant had a point about the difference between his homeland and the Duchy of Gwent. Singpu came from a tiny village, whose name Talbot had absolutely no intention of trying to pronounce, in Thomas Province. It was situated in the valley between the De Castro and Langhorne Mountains, the better part of 2,000 miles north of Talbot's own birthplace in Trokonos. In fact, it was 200 miles north of Zion itself, and everyone knew what winter was like in Zion. The temperature in Trokonos, on the other hand, rarely dipped below freezing even in midwinter, especially near the sleepy port of Eralth, where Talbot had grown up. Trokonans like Talbot could grow to adulthood without ever seeing a single snowflake, and many of them had. Thomas got just a little chillier than that, he supposed.
"I'm thinking it's cold enough for such as me to be going on with," he told Singpu. "Mind, I've seen 7 Zion winters in my duty book, and I'll allow Zion's a bit nippier than all this. But I've those fine-bred southern sensibilities, don't you know? Why, the next thing you know, there'll be great heaps of that white stuff. What do you call it? Snow, is it? All stacked about the landscape. And sure as there is, we'll all be turfed out of our snug little cabins to go march about in it."
Singpu laughed again, although Talbot probably had a point about the training march. They did a lot of that, and Talbot's predictions were seldom wrong. This southern weather really was ridiculously mild for someone who'd grown up in the De Castro's foothills, though. As long as it didn't rain, and the skies were currently clear, which helped explain the cold snap which was bothering Talbot so, he had no objection to spending time in the fresh air. Besides, it would be good for the men.
"And isn't that a strange thing for a shepherd from Thomas to be thinking?" he asked himself. "It's not that long ago you wouldn't have thought about whether or not something would be good for the men, and you wouldn't have cared either. And you can give Elaine a lot of the thanks for the fact that you're thinking about it now."
He concentrated on setting the stitches along the edge of the belt where he'd trimmed away the damaged leather. One thing a shepherd learned was how to mend things on his own. One thing a shepherd didn't learn was how to read, and Tangwin Singpu had been as close to illiterate as made no difference when he was drafted for the mighty host of God and the archangels. He'd been willing enough to go if Mother Church needed his services, but he'd been horrified when they made him a corporal the very day he mustered in, and then, during training, they'd promoted him to sergeant. And now, half a year later, he was the 231st Volunteers' standard-bearer, what the Army of God would have called the regimental color sergeant, the second-ranking non-com of the entire regiment. What did he know about being a sergeant? He was just a mountain boy from the De Castros. All right, so he was tough, since you either grew up tough or died in the De Castros. And he'd thumped a few skulls in hard-knuckle stand-up fights for beef and beer in his time. But a sergeant? Responsible for leading other men into battle against Shan Wei and all the forces of darkness? The idea had been ridiculous. And terrifying. Of course, if he'd known then what he knew now, he would have been terrified about a lot of other things as well. It was thanks to Talbot and the other AOG officers and non-coms assigned to the 231st that he not only knew enough to worry about those other things now, but might actually have learned enough to help the men he was responsible for survive them. He watched from the corner of his eye as the Sidermarkian spread his hands to the flames once more. When Talbot first turned up to replace the company's original Harchongese senior sergeant, Sing Poo had been in awe. He'd regarded the experienced, confident Talbot as some sort of archangel, or at least a senior angel. Where other members of the mighty host of God and the archangels had resented the imposition of foreign officers and non-coms, Sing Poo had been determined to soak up as much knowledge as he could. He was older than many of the conscript company's other corporals and sergeants, with a wife and four children back home, and he intended to get still older, God and Chihiro willing. If Talbot had something to teach, Sing Poo was only too happy to learn. But over the weary, exhausting 5 days, he discovered that the other man made an even better friend than he did a mentor. Unlike quite a few other people Sing Poo could name, he didn't look down his nose at the Harchongese serfs and peasants who'd been scooped up to fight the heresy. He'd rolled up his sleeves and done his job, and now he and Sing Poo were the non-commissioned backbone of an infantry company that was at least 5 or 6 times as dangerous to the enemy, not itself, than it had been before his arrival.
"A man could do worse than make a foreign friend who helps manage that," Sing Poo told himself. "Especially a foreign friend carrying around everything Alain is."
The entire province of Trokonos, led and inspired by Talbot's hometown of Eralf, had gone over to the heresy. The sergeant had had no word from any member of his family since the faithful had risen against Stonar's treachery to God and his church. He seldom talked about it, but he'd dropped a bit of personal information, probably more than he'd realized, from time to time. Sing Poo understood the shadows beneath his friend's normal good humor as he worried about his family's safety, and even about whether or not some of them might have joined the heresy. Sing Poo lifted the belt to bite off the thread, stowed the expensive needle carefully away, then stood and threaded the belt through his belt loops and buckled it snugly.
"Nice," Talbot told him with a chuckle. "Got a pair of boots, could use a little mending, happen you have the time for it?"
"Sorry to hear that," Sing Poo replied, reaching for his coat. "I promised Captain of Spears Swan Ji I'd drop in on the pickets this afternoon."
"Sneak up on him, you mean, hey?"
Talbot chuckled again and gave his hands one last rub.
"Never a day's work as warms the cockles of a sergeant's heart more than catching some poor sod snoozing on picket duty," he announced. "Let's do it, Tanguin."
The two of them headed out the door, laughing. Not far from the sergeant's cabin, Lord of Foot, Bangpa Shangjin, and Colonel Benjamin Crestman sat sharing a bottle of the colonel's precious, hoarded Chisholmian whiskey. Shangjin supposed he ought to feel guilty about consuming something produced by heretics, but it was the 30-year-old Glenfic. Not only did that make it one of the finest whiskies ever produced and reverently aged, but it had been distilled well before heresy had reared its ugly head in the out-islands. For that matter, it had been aging innocently away well before Charlian or Caleb Armok had ever been born.
"Father Brian might pick a few holes in that logic," Shangjin thought, "but he's a compassionate young man. Surely he wouldn't deprive someone 20 years his senior of what minor comforts might come his way in the field."
In fact, Brian Charles, the Shularite underpriest who served as the 231st Volunteers chaplain, he would have been called its intendant in the Army of God, was a compassionate young priest, someone who stood no nonsense, but a man who tried to be as understanding as he could where his often uncivilized and always uncouth charges were concerned. Had he been present, not only would he have cheerfully raised a glass with them, but done it with the respect the Glenfic's golden, honeyed fire deserved. Besides, it would have been an unforgivable insult to Crestman if Shangjin had declined. The colonel had suffered more than many for the jihad, a well-to-do Tanshar merchant before Shan Wei's minions had seized so much of the world by the throat, he and his family had been ruined by Carisian privateers and by Mother Church's embargo of trade with Karis. Then he'd lost his left arm in the bitter fighting in the Silmon Gap. A man who'd given that much to the Jihad deserved a little consideration, even if he was a barbarian. And, to be fair, he was much less of a barbarian than many. No one born east of the city of Zion, even in the Temple Lands, could be considered truly civilized, but Crestman came remarkably close. Well-educated, courteous, intelligent, and competent, it was scarcely his fault he hadn't been born Harchongese.
"What do you think about this new rifle, this St. Kilmon?"
the Lord of Foot asked, cradling his glass in his hands as he cocked his head at Crestman across the hearth. The lighting was too dim to really make out the colonel's expression. Crestman's quarters were a little better finished, but otherwise identical in construction to the vast expanse of Camp Number 4's chinked log barracks. The fireplace didn't smoke anymore, and it had a planked wooden floor, rather than the packed dirt of the non-commissioned and enlisted quarters, and he had it to himself. But there was no glass for the windows, and the shutters were kept tightly closed 4.5 days out of the 5 day once the weather turned what passed for cold here in Gwent. That left lamplight and firelight, and Shang Jin's eyes weren't as young as they'd once been. He'd grown accustomed to that, though, and also to the Spartan severity of Crestman's cabin. It was certainly a far cry from the sort of luxury which would have been demanded by a Harchongian who commanded a base which housed over 40,000 men, yet it was difficult to imagine the colonel anywhere else.
"I don't really know what to think, Bangba," Crestman replied after a moment. "Other than how much I want to get my hand on one of them and try it out myself."
He shook his head.
"If even half the things they're telling us are accurate, it's going to be a huge factor come spring."
Shang Jin nodded, his face expressionless as he considered all the things Crestman hadn't said. Neither of them had ever come right out and said it, but Shang Jin had concluded months ago that for all its destructiveness, the heretic's blasphemous raid on the canal system had been a huge stroke of God's own grace for the mighty host of God and the archangels. His expressionlessness wavered for a moment as he recalled Cressman's initial reaction to the mighty host's full name. How sad that Easterners had so little poetry in their souls. He did have to admit that it took rather longer to say than the army of God, though. The temptation to smile disappeared as he contemplated what would have happened if the destruction of the canals hadn't prevented the host from grappling with the heretics in battle last summer as planned. Not that every Harchongese officer, especially in the army's senior ranks, agreed with him about the desirability of the changes they'd been forced to confront since then. Benjamin Crestman leaned back, studying the Lord of Foot's body language, and suspected exactly what he was thinking. Bangpa Shang Jin was no fool, and no coward either. He hadn't volunteered for the mighty host of God and the archangels, but he'd been a well-to-do banker, related by marriage to the Baron of Wind-Kissed Grass, and the son, grandson, and great-grandson of the bureaucrats who truly managed the Harchong Empire. He'd had more than sufficient connections to avoid service, and he'd never even tried to use them. There were many things to like and admire about him, from his intelligence to his education to his faith and determination. Other things were less admirable, but that was probably unavoidable. He was an upper-class Harchongian, which meant by definition that he'd been reared to regard the conscripted serfs and peasants who made up the mighty host of God and the archangel's infantry as something south of human. He often treated them as semi-domesticated animals, somewhere between golden retrievers and monkey lizards. Yet he was genuinely devoted to their well-being, and he'd worked long and hard to see to it that they had adequate housing and properly observed Pasquale's law. The reverse could have been said about all too many Harchongese officers. And the Harchongese army was a product of the society and the support base which had produced it. Therein lay the problem. There had been a time when the Harchong Empire had been the terror of its neighbors. Its bottomless well of manpower had been supported by a manufacturing base whose productivity was only slightly inferior to the rest of Safeholds, and its artisans had been arguably the finest in the world. Even today, many Harchongese craftsmen were superb artists, true masters of their crafts. Unfortunately, there were very few of them in proportion to the empire's huge population, and there were even fewer mechanics. Harchong's craftsmen's work commanded huge prices from connoisseurs, while its army's arsenals were lumbered with obsolete weapons, some as much as 100 years old or more, which had been accumulated over the years. It possessed pitifully few modern weapons, and even its stockpiles of old model arms had been grossly inadequate to the present need. For all the Harchong Empire's enormous size, the Imperial Harchongese army had been sadly under strength before the Jihad. The last two emperors, or rather the bureaucrats who'd run the empire in their names, had gradually modernized the standing army over the last 50 years, replacing the feudal nightmare it had become during the preceding couple of centuries. There had been more than a little aristocratic resistance to building an army which answered to the crown rather than to them, but the bureaucrats had persisted. It must have been a difficult task for them to decide to undertake, even without the nobles' resistance, given their ingrained loathing of any idea that required them to spend money on anything that didn't put sizable sums into their own purses, yet they'd persevered stubbornly. Come to think of it, though, the graft for a project of that scale must have been enormous. The empire had traditionally relied upon cavalry for many reasons. One was the aristocrats' instinctive love affair, apparently as universal as it was deep, with horses. The princedom of Tanshar had its own nobility, but thankfully they'd been spared that particular fetish, although Crestman could have effortlessly reeled off a dozen off-color jokes about the real reason Harchongese nobles spent so much time with horses. More to the point, aristocratic Harchongians lived in terror of servile rebellion. With just cause, given the conditions under which so many Harchongese serfs existed, one really couldn't call it living, and the thing which had most amazed Crestman when he took up his new duties was the degree of loyalty and deference so many of the serfs and barely better-off peasants who'd been conscripted for Mother Church's service showed their hereditary overlords. One reason it had surprised him was that Harchong's serfs had rebelled on at least half a dozen occasions, and the bloodshed had been horrific each time. Atrocities had been brutal as the serfs struck back at their tormentors, and the examples made in the course of putting down the rebellions had been even worse. Both aristocrats and serfs had long memories, too. That was why Harchongese serfs were subject to summary execution for the possession of any missile weapon more sophisticated than a shepherd's sling, and it was also why the Harchongese army had relied on the mobility and shock effect, the psychological terror, of cavalry to deter servile violence. The army reforms hadn't really changed that, since almost 70% of the regular army was still mounted. The reformers had, however, built up a solid core of over 100,000 well-trained, well-armed, well-armored heavy infantry, supported by 30,000 bowmen and arbalesteers and a tiny handful of matchlock-armed musketeers. The IHA's true striking power, however, continued to reside in the highly mobile horse archers who composed nearly half its total manpower. There were various militia forces scattered around the empire, not to mention the notorious and justly feared Emperor's Spears, the Harchongese military police, but that standing professional army had become the true bulwark of the empire, and the bane of any aristocratic hope of a return to the days when the great lords had dictated to the empire's bureaucratic managers. There were still scores of feudal cavalry regiments, despite the reforms, manned by, commanded by, and answering to the aristocratic magnates who paid for them. In fact, technically, the feudal regiment's roster strength was twice the standing army's, but it was unlikely they could actually have produced more than 40%, 50 at the outside, of those official numbers. Yet the fact remained that exclusive of those ramshackle feudal regiments, whose effectiveness had to be highly suspect, The entire Imperial Harchongese army had numbered less than 500,000 men, horse and foot, with no field artillery at all at the beginning of the schism. And Lord of Armies Yitangji Gengchai, the Grand Duke of Omar and, officially, Imperial Minister of War, had done absolutely nothing to increase its size until the empire was formally summoned to jihad. Of course, Omar was the next best thing to 90 and an aristocrat, so expecting anything out of him would have been grossly unrealistic. The bureaucrats who actually managed the empire might have given the matter at least a little thought, however. They hadn't, with the result that they'd been forced to send out press gangs to conscript the manpower they needed to expand the standing army to meet the requirements of the mighty host of God and the archangels. They'd gone from a strength of 471,000 to one of over 1,300,000 in less than 4 months. With God only knew what kind of disruption in the farm villages from which those men had come, it was a remarkable performance Cressman doubted any other realm could have achieved, but a force which would have been effective at quelling rebellious serfs had to be viewed as a questionable match for the Republic of Sidermark army and its Carizian allies. Even with half the Emperor's spears included in the numbers, they'd sent that huge force off with barely 77,000 rifles and less than 80,000 pistols. It was reasonably well provided with bows, arbalests, even 67,000 slingers, but not with rifles. The regular army's archers, especially its horse archers, might actually have fared well against smoothbores or even against riflemen with muzzle loaders, given their volume of fire and the high standard of accuracy to which they'd been trained. But the heretics' breech loaders and mobile angle guns were another matter entirely. And however good the regulars' archery might have been, the horde of conscripted light infantry had, not surprisingly, been horrible marksmen. It took years to build a competent archer, although arbalists came a little easier, and any serf would have paid with his life if he'd been caught practicing with a bow or arbalist before being drafted. Almost worse, their upper-class aristocratic senior officers hadn't really wanted them to attain a worthwhile level of accuracy with their newly issued bows and arbalists, jihad or no jihad, since some of them might actually survive to return home. Surely sheer volume of fire would do the job without teaching them to actually hit individual targets. They would have found out differently if the mighty host of God and the archangels had met the heretics in battle, so it was fortunate they'd been spared that experience. Instead, the host had been parceled out in winter quarters like Camp Number 4, winter quarters constructed in ample time, thanks to Vicar Robert's management, along the rivers and canals in north-central Haven. And while they were parked there, AOG instructors and mentors, like one Benjamin Cressman, had been dispatched to train those conscripts. Quite a few of the Harchongese nobles had been horrified by the notion of teaching serfs to be effective soldiers. Serfs' battlefield function was to obediently die swamping the enemy by sheer numbers, opening a path by which their better trained, better armed, and far better born superiors charged to victory. It was not to acquire military skills they might take home and use against those better-born superiors the next time they rebelled. Men like Bangpa Shangjin might understand why those skills were necessary, might even enthusiastically support the effort of acquiring them, but it would have been asking too much for barons, earls, and dukes to share that vision. Fortunately, they hadn't had a choice. It had cost the Army of God dearly, but Captain General Maguire had found a bribe not even Harchongians could refuse. He'd offered to divert enormous numbers of rifles to the mighty host of God and the archangels, rifles his own army desperately needed, and to provide it with field artillery supplied by Mother Church and manned by AOG gunners. But only if he was allowed to send in trainers to ensure that those weapons would be used effectively in battle. Cressman suspected there'd been great wailing and gnashing of teeth back in Harchong when the semaphore delivered Vicar Elaine's terms, yet the Empire had found no choice but to accept them. There'd been bitter protests from many noble Harchongians, but the bureaucrats had stood firm. and this time the aristocracy had been denied even the support of its traditional ally, the Inquisition. The border states had been no happier, since they'd been required to surrender all of their rifles to the cause, which had produced 204,000 weapons. Coupled with the diversion of over 80% of the Temple land's own production, 50,000 from Dolar, almost 20,000 from Silkia, and 40,000 from Harchong's own manufactories, a total of over 506,000 rifles would have been delivered to the mighty host of God and the archangels by the end of the month. Assuming all the rifle makers involved met their quotas, the host would be able to put over 640,000 riflemen into the field by the time the canals thawed next spring. And somewhere around 14% of them would be armed with the new St. Kilmon breech loaders. The Harchongians would still have over 460,000 infantry who didn't have rifles, but virtually all of those would be equipped with arbalests, many scavenged from the pre-jihad arsenals of places like Dolar and Desnayer, and bows, aside from the 60,000 peasant slingers who would stick with the weapons they knew. It wouldn't be the same as having a million rifles to throw at the heretics, but it would still represent an almost incalculable increase in firepower. And equally important, those rearmed infantry would have had at least 3 months' training under Army of God tutelage. The arbalesteers would have time to acquire proficiency, the bowmen would at least have time to learn which end of the arrow fitted to the string, and the worst of their own officers would be weeded out, and where necessary and possible, replaced with AOG officers. At the end of the day, Benjamin Cressman thought, with a thin, hard little smile, the heretics who'd raised their hands against God and Mother Church and ruined his own family might just find the newly refurbished mighty host of God and the archangels a bit more difficult to deal with than they'd anticipated. Chapter 2. West of Chever, Cliff Peak Province, and near Bronsalik, the South March Lands, Republic of Sidermark.
"Excuse me, sir. I've got someone here I think you'd better talk to."
Major Craig Abrames looked up from the map his orderly was shielding with an oilskin poncho. Captain Avram Lansir, the commander of his Company B, saluted. Lansir was accompanied by an extraordinarily tall, gray-haired civilian with a most uncivilian-like rifle slung over his shoulder and an ugly, efficient short sword at his side. Abrame's eyes narrowed as they took in that rifle, for it was a trapdoor Mondrain, and there weren't supposed to be any of them in civilian hands, especially here in the Republic of Sidermark.
"And who might this someone be, Captain?"
he inquired coolly, raising one eyebrow at the stranger, and the civilian smiled.
"Think I'd best be answering that myself, Major,"
he said easily, in a pronounced Shiloh accent.
"Happens the name Slater, Japheth Slater. No, that's not likely to mean much to you, but Duke Eastshire, he knows me."
"Does he indeed?" Abraham's eyes didn't get any narrower. That would have been impossible, but the suspicion in them deepened.
"I hope you won't think I'm being unreasonable if I ask if you have any proof of that acquaintance, Master Slater, was it?"
"Aye, that it was," the civilian replied. "Can't say as I blame you for being a mite suspicious. Still, might be this'll help."
He opened his hand, and Abrames inhaled sharply as something glittered on his calloused palm. He'd never actually seen one of the small tokens, but they'd been described to him in detail. The enameled silver doom whale of Chisholm and golden kraken of Old Corus gleamed at him, and those tokens came from only two sets of hands, the royal hands to whom that doom whale and that kraken belonged. His gaze rose to the muddy brown eyes of the man who'd introduced himself as Japheth Slater.
"As I say," that man said in a much crisper accent, "I don't think anyone could fault your caution, but I really do need to speak to Colonel Vartanish."
So, Master Slade here, you've seen these supply wagons with your own eyes?
Colonel Cathill Vardenish gazed intently at his own map, eyes as focused as his thoughts, as his finger traced the line indicating the so-called road between Bronsilek and Roymark. The temperature had dropped, and it was raining harder. The tarp stretched between a pair of near oaks kept the worst of the precipitation off the map, but the drum of raindrops promised that an already miserable day was about to turn into a wretched one.
I have, Colonel.
Merlin Athrawis answered the question in Slater's voice. He'd never actually been to Bronsilek, but thanks to Owl's snarks, he could have walked the entire length of that miserable, muddy road blindfolded.
And the supply depots? You've seen them, too?
Vartanish looked up from the map, and Slater nodded.
They're still in the process of settling in, he said. I estimate they have 3 Dalaran infantry regiments in the town itself. There are probably another 3,000 quartermaster troops, but all the civilians have been moved out. They're building up a major supply point for their main field force, quickly, and the Desnarians really need it.
He grimaced.
Their horses are in trouble, Colonel, and their infantry's not much better. I'm not surprised.
Vartanish sounded satisfied, but he also frowned. Slater wasn't surprised by the frown. Duke Eastchair's plans had called for the army of Cliffpeak to be far closer to Roymark before anyone realized Earl Highmount was coming. Unfortunately, Sir Reynos Alvarez, at least, truly was capable of learning, and his cavalry patrols were spread directly across Highmount's approach march from Memphis.
I know you're not supposed to discuss His Grace's battle plans with any chance-met spy you happen to encounter, Colonel,
he said after a moment.
But it happens that I already know basically what he's hoping to accomplish.
Vardenish's eyes were suddenly bleak, and Slater smiled.
I don't plan on babbling on about them, even to you, Colonel, but there's no point pretending I don't know what's worrying you. And unfortunately, I think you're right. I don't see any way you'll be able to get as close to Roymark as His Grace hoped before Alvarez's cavalry spots you. And he's got a semaphore line all the way from Bronsilek to Roymark, and from there to Carmick. There's no way Earl Highmount can get his infantry into position before Alvarez and Harless know you're coming. And good as Brigadier Seacatcher and Brigadier Raisinger are, I really don't think they need to take on the entire army of Shiloh in the open west of the Kiplinger by themselves.
Vartanish's expression was as bleak as his eyes, and Slater waved gently.
No. I'm not really a cleverly disguised agent inquisitor here to mislead Earl Highmount into abandoning his orders, he said,
and Vartanish's color deepened. But then the colonel made himself draw a deep breath and relax, and Slater grinned at him.
If I were a cleverly disguised agent inquisitor, I'd try to find a less wet and miserable way to mislead the Grand Inquisitor's enemies, since, unfortunately, I'm a good, loyal Carizian spy instead. I'm here in this miserable weather to warn you about those patrols of Alvarez's before you run headlong into them. Actually, I suspect they've already spotted some of your flankers. They're Dalarans, not Desnarians, and they've been specifically ordered to avoid contact. I don't much care for Dalarans, you understand, but Alvarez has managed to convince his cavalry commanders that there's usually more value in reporting back when the enemy's spotted than there is in launching a glorious charge that tells him you know he's there.
I can't say I'm happy to hear that, Vartanish said after a moment.
I'd hoped they were still as clueless as they were last summer. Survival's a pretty demanding tutor, Slater replied.
I imagine so.
Vartanish looked back down at the map, frowning in thought, and Slater tapped the small, bland dot that indicated Bronsilek.
I don't think Alvarez realizes Earl Highmount's moving in such strength, and I'm sure Harless doesn't. His cavalry hasn't reported a damn thing, and if Alvarez starts talking about threats to their rear, Hannett'll assure everyone in sight that no one could possibly send a force big enough to pose a real danger across 350 miles of wilderness in the middle of winter. To supply enough men to threaten something the size of the army of Shiloh, they'd have to come straight down the canal past Chevert, where his cavalry's waiting to spot them. At the moment, they know there are at least some mounted troops in the vicinity, and Alvarez may be smart enough to suspect what Duke Eastchair has in mind,
but even he has to be half-convinced he's imagining things. So it may be time to convince him you've known about the supply depot at Bronzelik all along.
Shit!
Private Justin Mosteers flinched violently as something hot, wet, and coppery-tasting exploded over him. For a moment, all he felt was shocked surprise, but then, in quick succession, he heard a meaty sound like a powerful punch, a gurgling, choked-off cry, and the distant crack of a rifle. His head whipped around, and he realized the wet heat coating his face and steaming all down his buff leather coat in the frigid air was blood. Brigham Jodwale's blood. Mosdeer's eyes went wide in horror as his friend's right hand rose weakly to the gaping hole just above his collarbone. Aside from that one choking cry, Jodwale never made a sound as he toppled into the icy undergrowth. His horse shied as its rider crashed heavily into the low-growing branches, and then Mosdeers heard more rifle fire, more cries of pain and panic. He wrenched his eyes from his friend's body, ducking instinctively in the saddle as he looked wildly about for the source of that fire. Gray-white balls of smoke erupted all down the far side of the fallow cornfield, and he reined his horse around and drove in the spurs, galloping back down the overgrown farm track at reckless, breakneck speed while rifle bullets whizzed viciously past. 15 minutes later, he was making his report to Sergeant Roger Jackson, the only survivor of his 5-man section.
How the hell did they get all the way out here?
Sir Alexander Prescott demanded harshly.
It's ridiculous!
Sergeant Jackson understood that his company commander didn't really expect an answer to his question, and that was a very good thing because Jackson couldn't imagine what that answer might be. Third Company was barely 15 miles from Bronzelik, and the nearest Heretic Infantry was trapped in O'Hodlin's Gap, 500 miles away. The only reason they were out here in the miserable sleet and freezing rain was because Colonel Wickman had suggested to Captain Prescott that General Alvarez would take it as a personal favor if Third Company didn't allow any heretic cavalry close enough to Bronzelik to burn the place down. Colonel Wickman was not the sort of officer one argued with, even in weather like this, and about things as unlikely as a heretic cavalry raid across hundreds of miles of hostile territory, and so Third Company had set out on its patrol. It hadn't been raining when they left. That had begun just after they'd settled into their cold, miserable bivouac on the first night out. Now, 2 days later, they were on the return leg, eager to get back to Bronzelik's roughly built barracks, and they'd seen no sign of the Carisian cavalry which had been reported in the area last 5 day. Until now, that was.
Mosteers didn't get a good look at any of them?
Prescott asked.
No, sir, the company sergeant grimaced. Hard to blame him, really. This kind of weather, men dropping right and left.
He shook his head, expression grim.
Captain, it looks like he took a bath in blood. Realize it's not raining all that hard, but might expect it to be enough to wash some of it off. Probably did, when you come down to it, though you'd not think so to look at him. Reckon I'd have lit out right smartly myself, and come down to it. We're lucky any of them got back to tell us about it.
Prescott nodded unhappily. It was a miracle Mosteers had gotten back at all, and no one could blame the private for being unable to pick individual shooters out of the sodden undergrowth.
All right, I need messengers, he said. One to Bronzelik to warn Colonel Martin the enemy's in the vicinity. Then we send another one to Colonel Wickman, telling him the same thing, and another one to Colonel Gardner, and finally one to the nearest semaphore tower to send word directly back to General Alvarez. Yes, sir.
Sergeant Jackson touched the breast of his heavy buff coat in salute, and Prescott glowered up at the unfriendly sky.
I'll draft the dispatches while you round up the riders to deliver them, he said. And while you're doing that, pass the word that we'll be picking up the pace when we move on,
I don't know how much difference one company of light cavalry will make if the heretics are close enough to hit Bronzelik, but I know we'll do a hell of a lot more good helping Colonel Martin defend the place than we will freezing our asses off out here in this miserable sleet.
You really are a nasty person, a contralto voice observed as Merlin Athrawes piloted his recon skimmer across the cloudy night sky towards the Republic's capital. He'd been gone too long already, and much as he would have preferred to hang around in his Slater persona, he decided Japheth was likely to be as useful an alter ego as Abram Jevons. He couldn't justify it. "I have no idea what you could possibly be talking about," he replied. "And I think it's a bit unreasonable of you to accuse me of being a nasty person when we're both the same person." "Oh, no." The woman who decided to call herself Nemu Chwerio laughed from her north wing bedchamber in far-distant Monchir. "You very carefully didn't give me all your memories, Merlin, so don't try to maneuver me into giving you a pass by hiding behind 'we're all in this together.'" It was Merlin's turn to chuckle, although there was undeniably something weird about this conversation. Custom and regulation alike had discouraged Pika owners from having discussions between their Molly Cirque selves and their flesh and blood selves. Personalities could get into nasty narcissistic feedback loops that way, especially personalities already pushed to the brink by the despair of the long losing battle against the Gababa. Like most Pika users, Nemu Alban had skated the edge of that band once or twice, just to see what it felt like, but odd as that had seemed, it hadn't been like this. Nemu Alban's biological and electronic selves had been effectively identical when they sat down face to face, but there were enormous differences between Merlin and the woman he'd decided deserved the name Nemu far more than he did after so long as Merlin Athrawes. They truly were different people, yet different people who shared the identical memories, the same life, up to the very instant they'd awakened here on Safehold. It was immensely comforting to know there was someone else in the universe who truly remembered the Terran Federation's long, hopeless war and the sacrifices so many had made to bring humanity here to this world where it might survive. Yet knowing someone else remembered also made his sense of loss for all that had disappeared forever even sharper. While rejecting the base canard that a fearless Saiyan such as myself might attempt to hide behind anything, he said, "I reiterate that I am not a nasty person. All I did was present my data to the appropriate decision-makers with a suggested course of action. Earl Highmount is a very bright fellow, and I strongly suspect he would have arrived at the same conclusion even without my input. I merely hastened the process along." "And used poor General Alvarez's own security arrangements against him," Nemu pointed out. "The same way you have ever since you convinced him Kurbish is still alive. If that's not nasty, then tell me what is. I believe there's an old saying about everything being fair in love and war," Merlin shrugged. "I will admit I'm developing a grudging respect for him, though, which I didn't expect." "I suppose I am, too," she said after a moment. "In fact, I think I regret what's likely to happen to him if this works. You know Clinton's going to blame him, since he's the one who sent Slate here to Harless for the Wyverns." "I know." Merlin pursed his lips for a moment, then sighed. "I don't regret it as much as I regret what's probably going to happen to Thirsk. But you do have a point, especially about Clinton. But you know, as much as I want to rip out Jaspar Clinton's heart, it's a relief to be fighting someone I actually understand instead of the Gababa." "Understand Jaspar Clinton?" "In the sense of being able to at least comprehend his motives, I meant. I'll admit it's worse in some ways to be able to understand what's going through his head, because he is a human being, and the things he's willing to do are even ghastlier than the Gababa. They wanted to destroy the entire human race, and they were prepared to do whatever that took, but nothing suggested they did it out of innate cruelty. I'm not saying they had anything remotely like compassion. They were aliens, and we never did figure out how, or if, their minds actually worked. They didn't seem to care how cruel their actions might be, though, because they were simply interested in the most efficient way to exterminate us. Quintan does care. Merlin's voice hardened, harshened. He rejoices in crushing anyone who gets in his way. He doesn't just do it, Nemu. He revels in it. It empowers him, and every person who dares oppose him becomes his personal enemy, to be destroyed as painfully as possible. And despite all that, I comprehend what he's trying to accomplish, and I can stop him. I hate him more than I ever truly hated the Gababa, but there's not that sense of facing some unstoppable force that can't possibly be defeated and could care less about me as an individual. We didn't have that against the Gababa, and it's taken me a while to realize what an enormous difference that makes this time around. Nemu was silent for a long, thoughtful moment. She was already discovering that he and Narman had been right about the other members of their inner circle. She didn't actually know any of them yet, not the way Merlin knew them, or they knew Merlin, but she could see the bright, fierce light of them. And as she thought about that light, she realized Merlin was right about the difference between this war and Nemu Alban's. The grim determination, the refusal to yield which had carried Nemu and her companions forward in the face of certain defeat, had its echo in Caleb and Charlian. In Michael Stainer and his brother, in Edward Hausman, Iris and Hector Aplin Armach, Roger Macklin, the Brethren of St. Gernot. But there was far more to them than that. They'd raised mortal hands against what they'd been taught was God himself, and what drove them was a fusion-bright will to win. Not merely the unflinching resolve to stave off defeat as long as possible, which was all fate and history had been able to offer the Federation, but the willingness, the courage, to see victory on the far side of their struggle. For an instant, she felt a dark, corrosive anger, an arsenic, bitter rage that these people had been given what she and everyone she'd ever loved had been denied. That they could actually envision a future in which they triumphed, in which the things more precious to them than life itself survived. But it vanished as quickly as it had come, that anger, vanished into sudden exultation as she realized that this time she could see victory as well. This time, her hands would be among the hands that cast down the darkness, led in the light, and allowed the human race not merely to survive, but to take the war back to the Gababa in the fullness of time and give that victory to all of her beloved dead. Apika's tears burned her eyes as she recognized the gift Merlin had given her by bringing her back from dusty death. He'd offered her a foe worth fighting, a cause worth winning, friends worth loving, and an opportunity in the end to avenge her slaughtered worlds and murdered Federation. It was worth dying to be given that, and worth living once again as well, even if someday she found herself bearing the same burden, the same memories which touched Merlin Athrawes with that perpetual trace of melancholy.